the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. Today we have a special episode. We're doing the third in our series of QAnon podcasts. And I'm here with Will and Jared. Thanks for being here, guys.
Yep, how's it going?
Thank you.
You might remember Jared from a previous podcast we did. I think he was episode, I think it was 4 or 5.
It was an early
one of the first ones. So we've got him back here because we've got him into Q, and he's been following along with us. So we thought he'd tag along and give us some insight. We're going to start off first with a little bit about the IG report. We're trying to tie in the IG report with the rest of the Q drops because the two seem to go hand in hand in a lot of ways. Q has been referencing it for a while and has said it's fairly significant. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to have Will open it up with a little background on the IG report in case you didn't have time to read all 500 pages.
Yeah, and then Mark will jump in and kind of insert anything that's relevant to Q, anything that pertains really to the whole process of unveiling the mystery behind this IG report, which is kind of like, I mean, first of all, it's a 568-page report. It's a behemoth. And as soon as they released it, what was it, June 14th on President Trump's birthday?
Yeah.
As soon as they released it, immediately there are headlines.
Yep.
They're saying, like, this is a definitive analysis of the report.
Yeah. And a lot of that comes from the conclusions made in the report. And a lot of those have been contentious to a lot of people. And we'll get into that a little bit later.
Exactly. So just from a very, like, a top perspective, a bird's eye view, if you're on a leftist media site or a legacy media site, the consensus is that there's no evidence that any investigative decisions within the Clinton email investigation were affected by political bias. And so that was one of the key findings in the report. That was it Horowitz, the author of the report, that he concluded was that there was no evidence directly connecting agents such as Peter Strzok and then Lisa Page, who were having an illicit affair, exchanging messages about their animus about Trump. There's no direct evidence that links their decisions to their political bias. And so it's of course, like, there is no direct evidence because you can't prove that somebody's actually operating with bias, but you can prove that the bias is there. And with these kind of sensitive matters, with anything involving the courts or investigations, if there's an appearance of bias, you're not supposed to be anywhere near
the case.
You're supposed
to recuse yourself. So.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's what, you know, General AG Sessions did in this very case with respect to the Russia investigation. But interestingly enough, Strzok was handling both the Russia and Clinton cases at the same time, and there were a lot of cases in which he decided somewhat intentionally to forego the Clinton investigation in sake of the Russia investigation. And they opened up this investigation with its own name in July 31st of 2016, and they called it Crossfire Hurricane.
Just a typical badass, like, investigative name for Trump. I mean, the one for Clinton was mid-year exam.
So. Yeah, you can see by the naming how they were treating these people.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so I'm sure everybody knows about the text messages exchanged between these two agents. I think Peter Strzok was high. He was like the deputy, what was he, one of the very subordinates to the deputy attorney general.
To McCabe, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, to McCabe, who at the time was the, what was he?
He was the deputy director of the FBI, I believe.
Right, okay. Yeah, so basically, like, outside the extent of these two investigations, the Russia election investigation and the Clinton email investigation, the main part about the report that I thought was really interesting was that it shows that there's this prevalent culture of the FBI of insubordination. So you have Comey, who's didn't get permission from his bosses, you know, Attorney General Loretta Lynch at the time and Deputy Attorney Sally Yates, didn't get permission to disclose matters about the investigation. Because when you're talking about investigatory matters with somebody who is of public repute, like Hillary Clinton was at the time, you're supposed to be very sensitive about how you talk about the case in public. And so he was insubordinate there. There are also people all across the FBI, agents leaking left and right information like the who's being subpoenaed, who's why there are grand juries being impaneled to request evidence or request indictments, because that's also information that if got onto the public could harm somebody's reputation. And for the last part, which I thought was just egregious, was that a lot of these FBI agents have personal relationships and quid pro quo relationships with reporters. And so they'll go out with reporters on lunch, they'll get free food, they'll get sports tickets, they'll get invited to social organizations and parties. It's just ridiculous. I mean, whatever you think about the FBI and law enforcement, and I'm a big fan of both of them, at least when affected properly, this is just bad from any angle. You know, you shouldn't have people that are leaking like FBI agents. It's, there needs to be a cultural shift in the FBI, and that's like the main conclusion.
Yeah, and in D.C., all these people are rubbing shoulders with each other. I mean, they're all part of the same social circles, and you see that especially in the case of, you know, McCabe's wife was running for, what was her position?
She was running for the state Senate seat in Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had been given, I think, was it $750,000 in donations from the D-Trip, the DCCC, the Democratic, was it, whatever it is,
yeah,
the convention.
Yeah.
And she had been given money from the McAuliffe, the then governor of Virginia. And so she was, of course, surrounded by political bias, at least appearance of, and he never recused himself. To be fair to him, he did go to the Office of Ethics and asked if he should recuse himself from the Hillary investigation at the time or the Russia one afterward. And they said no. But the reason they said no is because they didn't consider the fact that his wife was a key member of the Democratic Party. They just slipped their minds somehow. And so that was allowed to stand. But really, there was a big imbalance between how the investigation into Russia was conducted and how it was conducted into Hillary Clinton. I mean, everybody remembers that famous speech Comey gave to Congress or to the presser that he announced, in which he completely absolved Hillary Clinton of all wrongdoing.
But, you know, it's interesting because now if you turn on Fox News, the one, you know, Hillary strategist that they'll have on talking about it, they'll say that Comey was the single biggest cause of Hillary's loss, that you know, that grandstanding had actually hurt her in several instances. But at the same time, you see in some of these tarmac meetings, they're essentially instructing him to call it a matter instead of a case. And so they've done this to themselves in a lot of ways. They've essentially coerced someone into doing something, and the end result was not that, the reciprocation was not what they expected. And so now they're blaming him. And Hillary has turned her back on Comey. So one of the interesting things that also came out was how many other officials were using these email servers. There were, I think, 13 other officials, most of them Obama cabinet members. And that's really important. So you have 13 members, Loretta Lynch, Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris?
Valerie Jarrett. President Obama himself is using it.
Yeah.
Contradicting his public statements, which he claimed he had no knowledge of it ever in any point.
Yeah, and so and that starts to paint a very clear picture as to why this really couldn't be pursued by DOJ at that time. Because if you were going to do this, you were going to implicate a past president. So if Hillary was held accountable, that would mean that the rest of the people using the servers would be held accountable. What they were doing with these servers and why they needed these private servers, that's a case that I think we're going to find out a lot more about in the coming months and hopefully not years. But that, you know, directly ties all of these people together. We find out that Comey has one. And in a way, to tie it back to Q constantly references Eric Schmidt and talks about how Google was responsible for a lot of these accounts. We're not sure if they were putting certain things on their servers. But if you look back to the campaign, Google was very clear that they were, well, at least Eric Schmidt was very clear that he was putting together a crack team to help Hillary win the election using all the developer means that he had at its disposal. There was an article that Q linked where they talk about how the most valuable resource to campaigns isn't necessarily money, it's talent now, and that he was bringing over a lot of his top developers to help her. And so there's a very close relationship by those two parties, and that's something that I think we should follow more closely. But more importantly, I think as well, is Rod Rosenstein is mentioned in this. So Rod Rosenstein would have been the deputy attorney general under Loretta Lynch, if I'm correct.
That was Sally Yates.
That was Sally
Yates. Rod Rosenstein is currently in the administration, right?
He was in it before. So he was...
he could have been one of the other deputies.
Yeah. So anyway, but he essentially had one of these servers as well. And he would have also had to sign the FISA warrant that would have tapped Trump Tower. So this is where all of these investigations start to link in with each other. And that's why, you know, when Trump first started talking about the wiretapping, everyone thought he was crazy. But the more we find out, the more we realize, and this is something that we had, what's his name on? Roger Stone on recently talking about how the FBI used an informant to try to entrap the Trump campaign. So he says that the informant wanted $2 million for damaging information on Hillary Clinton. He specifically asked that that money be paid from Donald Trump's personal account, which is obviously a clear source of entrapment. And that meeting was happening during the campaign, long before this investigation, actually shortly before this investigation was opened. So more and more evidence seems to point to the conclusion that they were trying to use any means necessary to entrap Trump within this narrative during the election, but also as an insurance policy after the election. But in doing so, having signed these FISA warrants that were essentially justified with a dossier and shady, you know, FBI agents, you start to realize that this is all a cohesive picture, especially when you start to understand that Strzok, who would have been in charge of this investigation, was telling his, you know, lover that he wasn't going to let Trump win, that, you know, it's pretty clear the guy in charge of the Russia investigation shouldn't be rooting that hard against a guy like Trump.
Yeah, and another thing that was, I mean, a very important thing to remember, too, is that the IG report did not conduct any review of the Russia investigation. That's going to happen in a couple years, I bet. We won't see that for a few years. And so I think a lot of people were looking to the IG, the release of the IG report, as some sort of bombshell that was going to just completely collapse the entire Obama administration and indict all of them. But that one's not to come. But like the one part that was really interesting about how it pertained to the Hillary Clinton investigation was that the part about the language change that you're mentioning when Comey was requested to change some of his language in his presser, one of the things they changed was from grossly negligent, which is actually inside the criminal statute, which provides for indictment, to, what was it, extremely careless. And so that language change is actually part of, it references back to a code in the department policy within the Department of Justice that you cannot make any official announcements without having evidence to back it up, or you can also not use language that's similar to a crime if you're going to talk about somebody in public and then not bring charges against them. And so what they did was they realized that if they absolved Hillary Clinton, they had to completely change the language and lie and say that it wasn't gross and negligent, which it was, for her to use a private email server and have so many glaring loopholes in it. They changed that to extremely careless, which it also was, but that's a completely different thing legally. It's going from one to zero.
And so one thing that Q talked about prior to the release of this document is he said that there were essentially three versions of this report. So you had the unredacted version and the complete report that he got on his desk. Then you had the redacted report. And then you had the modified redacted report. Let me make sure that was correct. But essentially he said that only one of these reports would be released. And when it was released, he had said that the third version of the report was going to be released. So it wasn't going to be the full report. There were going to be pieces moved around, and essentially the conclusions were going to be off. And so one thing, when you if you listen to some of the Senate testimony today, they were pressing Horowitz on the timeliness that it took, so the amount of time that it took for them to reopen the investigation based on the new evidence of the laptop that they were attempting to introduce through the Southern District of New York. And so they essentially ask, and he confirms that it was slowed, but not by him, and that was by Rosenstein. So he implicates Rosenstein essentially opening the door to a situation where Rosenstein may need to recuse himself because of his own bias, or he might be so badly implicated that there's a grand jury or something placed specifically for his involvement as it pertains to the FISA warrants, but also covering up some new evidence that had come to light. And it took, I think, over a month. So from September 20th to October 21st, I think, they had requested the laptop, heard nothing back. Finally, they made an additional request. They pushed harder, they got the laptop, but said they weren't going
to... Exactly. Yes, they tried. The Southern District of New York Office of the FBI tried to analyze Anthony Weiner's laptop because it did contain photos of underage women.
Yeah.
And so what they did was the people in New York found emails from ClintonEmail.com, and they said, okay, we're not allowed to look at this because our investigation is restricted to Weiner. And so they called the FBI and said, you know, this guy, you guys need to take this now. This is another like 350,000 to 600,000 emails that's, you know, could be completely new. It could be from when Hillary Clinton didn't have any security on her system and could implicate her in being grossly negligent with classified information. And let's just say people at the FBI just said, okay, we'll take care of it. And a couple of weeks go by, they keep hounding on him, say, hey, you guys need to take this. They try to send it to him, and finally they did, and then they processed it within 1 week somehow. And it was just all completely suspect because they just wanted to wrap it up before the investigation. And Comey just thought he was just the grand adjudicator of all morality. And he said that, okay, I've got to be the one to save the justice, like the absolute justice. And so he goes out and completely absolves Hillary Clinton because he wants her to not have a cloud over her presidency. But in so doing, he completely screwed up her campaign and her chances. I really do think that it had a material impact, or at least a noticeable one, on her chances, because like the vote difference between, or the margin between her and Trump for electoral college was under 100,000 votes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's definitely, it's just funny that they tried to rig the system in a way that kind of was like a taint on justice, so they could claim that it was justice. But the way they did it just completely ruined their own chances. It's just karma.
And this is one of the reasons why Q has said they need to clear out the DOJ and the FBI before they can go through with any of the prosecutions that they really want to make. So you can't have, you have to have an impartial justice system before you can try and go after any of these top-level officials. Some of the things that Q has said that seem interesting and seem relevant, he said that Podesta and Huma Abedin are essentially indicted, but they are sealed indictments, so we wouldn't know about it yet. The Podesta group has gone pretty quiet. John Podesta has been on Ancient Aliens, but he seems to be making some of his last messages. Q mentions that the IG can't disclose evidence for pending criminal cases in public disclosures and reports. So any criminal matters that are currently under investigation would not be included in the report, and I think that's pretty important. Horowitz reveals that Comey is under investigation, and so I think that's an important piece. And I think
that was official too, right? Yeah. Completely within the hearing under testimony. So Comey is under investigation right now.
Yeah. Okay. And so one thing Q says is that Peter Strzok is a cooperating witness now. So if that was the case, then that would make sense, I think. I think he's someone who probably flipped. And if they're going to get his testimony, then there's a good chance a lot of the bigger players above him, like Comey and like Rosenstein and others, would be implicated by default. Let's see. He also mentioned that Jeff Sessions and Huber would be the ones who would handle prosecutions. The IG was never really meant to do that. That part's not too important. So
yes, if you want to just like transition from the IG report into more of Q's latest postings, I know he's been quite active, at least maybe somehow regarding the tariffs or the Korea situation or anything.
I mean, I first wanted to start as an interesting transition. So we talk about the 13 members of Obama's cabinet with these private emails. But Q also mentions that 42 members of Obama's cabinet, administrative staff, sorry, not cabinet, obtained an FBI bypass. So they didn't need a background check, which is very suspect.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was there, they made me go through a pretty intense background check and I was just an intern. So you'd think someone working in the administration, would need to go through a background, and that's something a lot of people don't know. So he asked why that is, and he posted one picture of Obama. It looked like he was in college with a Pakistani guy, and they were holding hands, actually. And he seemed to implicate that he was one of the guys in Obama's cabinet who was given access to privileged information and then was then allowed to transfer that information or leak that information to Pakistan directly. And he again references guy who had the laptop, destroyed the laptop.
Right,
the Pakistani. Yeah, Awan.
He wasn't holding his hands, though.
He wasn't. He was just, I think the Pakistani reference, too, also was connecting him to the ISI in Pakistan, which had been sheltering Osama bin Laden throughout Obama's administration, and they made a deal with ISI to get him exchanged, and so they had him killed.
And also, there's a lot of references to the Muslim Brotherhood infiltrating parts of the Obama administration and also Clinton. So
right, because of Huma Abedin. Right.
Exactly. And if you look into Huma's history, she has some very deep ties. I think her mother is the president. So, you know, that's an interesting thread to unravel, but we've gone through that a little bit in our past podcasts. As far as the North Korea deal, so this is something Q has been talking about forever. I mean, back in, I think it was January, he was talking about the fact that he had already met with Kim Jong-un. Actually, that was even further back than January. And that the terms were already set, that essentially this was just theatrics. And we've been saying for a while, and you know, everything went off without a hitch. He posted the site of the Singapore summit before they had announced it on the news. I've been to Singapore, and the most readily identifiable structure is, you know, the three-columned hotel with the giant oasis on top. I can't remember the name of it. Beautiful building. But he posted a picture of that before the location was announced, and he said some other interesting things. So he said that Obama tried to call Kim before the summit but didn't have his number. And I think this again references Eric Schmidt, who he had said had set up the telecom networks in North Korea, and they essentially had a foothold in the country. And that's why Kim had been traveling to China to meet with Xi. And there was actually a senator who mentioned that Obama had tried to do this. And Q asked how it was that the senator had this, you know, privileged information. If you look at a lot of North Korean media, I think it's pretty clear that they're getting ready for reunification. I think what we did with the drills, stopping the drills were expensive. You know, they really pissed off North Korea. We would probably be pissed if someone pretended to invade our country every year. And,
right.
And Trump's right when he says it costs a lot of money. It's literally taxpayer money going into building bombs that we blow up in the middle of nowhere just to practice. You know, and these are $1 million a piece and bombs half the time.
People are conflating our troop station in South Korea with the military exercises every year. You know, it's one thing to put the troops on the table, and President Trump has no intention of doing that. He's saying he's keeping troops in South Korea because if you do denuclearize, the threat is that if you pull troops out of South Korea, they'll just invade South Korea and they won't stand a chance. And so ending the war games is just a move, a sign of confidence, of good faith. And so, yeah, there's really nothing to criticize.
And the thing is, the generals really like Trump because Trump isn't going around and sending all of their people into needless wars, stationing them overseas for no reason. You know, these people want to be back home.
Wait, let's see how that turns out when he sends them to space, though.
I think
I'll sign up for that. Yeah.
I think they're just slowly rolling out all the alien technology they haven't told us about, but that's for another time. And interestingly enough, I think John Kelly was still a pretty big part of these talks, even though the mainstream media really hasn't reported much on that. One thing he does mention about Rod Rosenstein is that he's out of the country, and he insinuates that he's investigating Five Eyes, which would mean putting Congress against the DOJ in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly how he's tying Paul Ryan into it, but he also mentions Paul Ryan's lame duck period as being important. When he talks about Rod Rosenstein being out of the country, I would reference this post, which I think is interesting. And this goes back to a post with a bunch of pallets. It looked like they were filled with smartphones. And this was right around the time of ZTE. And one of the theories was that these ZTE phones were distributed to people like Hillary, Bill, Barack Obama. So they thought these phones couldn't be tracked or monitored, and this was how they were communicating, and they were using Gmail on these phones. And so when Hillary was in New Zealand, they said it wasn't just to raise funds, but it was to test these phones in a Five Eyes country. And then under the directions of Trump, apparently New Zealand told Hillary the phones weren't good, and as a result, ZT has been, you know, in the news lately.
They've been assessed a whopping, $2 to $4 billion fine. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was a big amount. And they'd think now, in order to continue doing business in the United States, the government has to, or they have to pay for somebody to be retained on staff who can provide access to for the government to come in and look at their facilities and make sure they're not breaking the law or otherwise harming our political system as they were before, allegedly.
So, I mean, from there, there's an interesting post about he's asking earlier on in May why the New York Attorney General was removed. I think that's directly related to Anthony Weiner's laptop. And I think it's also related to Rudy Giuliani joining Trump's legal team. So if you think about the NYPD, Giuliani was a huge champion for them. He's still got deep ties in there. And it would be pretty rational that if they were sitting on something pretty massive, he would be one of the guys who would know about it. And he would be one of the guys who can help bring that to light. There was another reason why I think Giuliani was able to do that. I can't remember now. As in respect to like North Korea, so as soon as North Korea was finalized, and actually a little bit before, Q said that after North Korea, the next target was going to be Iran. And Q also went on to ask if people had noticed a lot of Iranian resistance fighters, when he quoted saying that they were freedom fighters, posting about QAnon on Twitter, asking why that might be, insinuating that there might be sort of a coup dwelling up in Iran. And then he talked about European countries and why they were pressing Iran and the United States to stay in this nuclear deal, essentially saying that they just had a lot of money to be made. They had deep investments in industry, and it was never really about nukes. It was about all the cash that we sent them, $150 billion, that was then, you know, redistributed in various ways.
And the comparison between North Korea too and Iran, a lot of people are making this comparison saying, okay, well, how come the deal in North Korea isn't the deal you want at Iran? But they're two separate countries, and they're on different stages of the road to diplomacy. Iran still has the threat of nuclear war because they still sponsor terrorism in the region of the Middle East. They're still combating Saudi Arabia and Yemen. They're still funding, was it the Hezbollah in the Gaza Strip? And so the reason that we can't just go in and trust and give our good faith and trust to Iran and Iranian diplomats, whatever they're called, the Ayatollah and the regime, the reason we can't do this is because they're actually threatening war and destruction of the Israelis. And that's actually a material threat, whereas with Kim Jong-un, it was all a negotiation tactic, at least in the opinion of people who actually know about this stuff, you know, higher than myself.
So taking it back to the beginning, Q starts... and this is a recent post, but talking about how Trump really got started, he says that essentially Trump was recruited by, you know, military generals. He's been vaguely talking about that for a while, but he gets more specific. He says that Eric Prince, who is the head of Blackwater and the DeVos family, essentially recruited Trump because they had a good feeling for what was happening in the government. And he says that Blackwater was operating as a double agent of sorts. So that picture with John McCain and several Al-Qaeda leaders and the head of ISIS, I think they recently killed him. But there was a picture leaked of John McCain with all these essentially heads of terrorist organizations. and Q was saying that Blackwater was a double agent, and they were documenting all the things that they were following these people along for, when these people thought that they could use Blackwater to get places they couldn't go with the assistance of the military or some other force to keep them safe when they were taking these under the table meetings. In response to Flynn, so he said the DeVos family was a big contributor, and they are a major donor in many ways. In response to Flynn, Flynn was military intelligence, so he's one of the guys who would probably know about a lot of this stuff that's happening. If you take him and Admiral Rogers, I believe, of the NSA, those two guys pretty much knew what was going on all over. And he said that Flynn wanted to get framed. So Flynn sat next to Putin at that dinner, knowing that this Russia investigation was starting to take hold and that he would probably get, you know, he would probably get interviewed as a result. He seems to say that they expected this. And that when Flynn testified, he did so that they could get the truth about where all the bodies were buried on the record. So when Flynn testified, he not only gave his testimony in respect to his own involvement, but also everyone else's involvement. And that when that was on the record, now it can be pursued further by a special counsel. He talks also a little bit about, you know, the mainstream media and QAnon. He talks specifically about Snopes.com. He asks, you know, where they got their funding. There are several other tools, one of which is talked about in a Snopes article, something called Hamilton 68, which is quoted as a live tool operated by the Alliance for Securing Democracy, a bipartisan transatlantic initiative housed at the German Marshall Fund of the United States that tracks Russian bots and paid trolls on Twitter. The Santa Fe High School shooting was the top trending topic as of afternoon and evening on May 18th, 2018.
Would you look at the top hashtag right now is QAnon. Would you look at that? For that Hamilton 68. That's funny. That they're tracking.
Really?
Yep, that's the top hashtag.
Yeah, and so this is something Q has talked about before, saying that a lot of his followers, they're attempting to frame them as Russian bots and say that, you know, this movement is falsified. This is all a giant Russian hoax. They're trying to lump all these people together, and then they're trying to ban a lot of the supporters from voicing their opinions by essentially calling them bots.
Yeah, like, Jared, have you met any Russians recently that have tried to convince you of stuff that you believe?
Yeah, no. Yeah. But there are a lot of people that are pretending to, like, be your friends and stuff on social media.
Yeah, exactly.
That
LinkedIn
do that same
too.
Exact
yeah.
thing. Yeah, so they'll make, like, a mock profile of some random person. They'll take their picture, their profile, all that stuff. And then they'll add all the same friends that you have. And then they'll
right.
add you. And then you won't even, like, be able to realize it. Because they don't, like, straight up message you and tell you these things. But they might post a couple things that get you at least thinking about different things that you wouldn't normally think about. So
exactly, yeah. Because, I mean, Russia did have an interest in disrupting. I mean, I do think that... I don't know whether they truly supported Trump, because we're still waiting to see the evidence on that. And that's something you can't just claim, right, in public without having the material evidence. But they did try to stir up a little bit of discord in our process during the 2016 election by... having, like, funding all these activist groups and pouring support into both sides, so the extremes get propped up on,
right.
on either in the middle ground, just thinks that they're lost hopelessly.
Right. And,
yeah.
and so what I think the play for them is not necessarily to combat the information, but, you know, the right information is out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can just flood the whole internet with a bunch of random information,
right.
then you have to logically, as a human, discredit all of it, because you couldn't find, like, one actual source. If, like, 10 different sources are possibilities, then you can't necessarily lean toward one side if all 10 are actual possibilities.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Exactly, and the problem with that, too, is when there's a flood of misinformation is that it just makes you trust only what you already believed in the first place. So
right.
it just kind of scrapes away all the
surface
level.
And that's a cognitive bias
stuff.
That people have,
yeah.
is that, like, the first piece of information you hear, you tend to hold more weight on that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Even if it's not true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's something that definitely merits some sort of neutral party or third party neutral investigation
right.
or some sort of something like that, but it can't be political and tied to Trump. I feel like the investigation into Russia and the investigation into Trump, while they might be connected at surface level, the reform campaigns that are trying to, you know, strengthen our democracy, or of course using to appropriate the terms of the other side, should be completely neutral and nonpartisan.
Mm.
And unfortunately, it's just hard. I mean, it's easy for me to say that because I'm not on that side. But
and we're even
yeah.
seeing a big thing on,
mm-hmm.
on social media, for example. Of celebrities that are being a big influence on that. They don't necessarily
mm-hmm.
talk about politics, but you have big celebrities coming out, we'll say John Legend, for example, that are totally against Trump, and they agree with all these different bad things that are being said about Trump, even though it's a fake article with, like, a big headline on it that's totally misleading, that doesn't have any actual statistics or proof or anything. And so you have celebrities talking about this stuff, so most people follow the celebrities that actually have no idea what are going on in the real world. So
yep.
it's interesting, because even though, like, that stuff is coming out, you're saying that.
Yep. And even, like, with John Lennon, too, didn't he send those texts to Kanye about, you know, you need to rescind your...
Yes.
I mean, he didn't...
Him and Kanye are good friends,
yeah.
like, in
oh, they,
person.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, they talk a bunch and stuff, but...
Okay.
And it's interesting you bring up Kanye, too, because Kanye's been on this thing, so he's... I can guarantee that before he had that one Make America Great Again hat, everyone is giving controversy about that. And before he even met Trump at the Trump Tower, and there was a big controversy about that,
right.
I can almost guarantee he's met with somebody in that regime area before, like years before, because you've seen it. If you go up on YouTube and look at the last show that he ever gave before his quote-unquote hospitalization, you can see the different rants he was having about, like, Beyonce and Jay-Z supporting, like, Hillary Foundation and all this stuff, and you see Chance the Rapper, like, different celebrities that are supporting the Clinton administration. And then you see Kanye being, like, the outlier of the whole thing. And then Kanye's most recent albums, each of the artists are kind of hinting at different political things, talking about different corruption in the government, talking about breaking spiritually and mentally free of these different societal beliefs that we've been boxing each other in on. So it's weird that like socially everything is also like politically tying together right now.
Yeah, exactly. And when you bring up the Beyonce and the Jay-Z thing, the difference between them and Kanye is Kanye's not going and stumping for Trump at his rallies, right? Kanye went and met with him at the tower and said, you know, my city, the city from which I came is in turmoil right now, or at least not turmoil. I'm sure he used separate words, but, you know, he's saying, can you help us? Can you affect a policy that's good and it's going to benefit people instead of just tearing people apart, instead of going on the campaign trail and stumping for him like a political activist? So.
I think the political play is that, you know, they're using like Kanye, the crazy outspoken guy, to actually get information out, because most people will just discredit him because he's already said crazy things about Taylor and all these other things. So he's the one that's crazy enough to say it. But the play for Kanye is that, he's actually getting this information that he actually, I think he's a good guy.
Oh yeah. I do too. Like,
outside of that stuff. But
yeah, you know. I mean, I've never met him, so I can't make a definitive claim, but I mean, he just seems like a decent guy. I mean, I also pity him for having to struggle with his bipolar disorder. So, I mean, that can't be easy for anybody. But anyway, yeah, I think what he's doing is good to raise awareness. Also, he's also had like a statistical bump on Trump's support among Black Americans. I think that whether it's causal is a different story, but it is correlated. Kanye's support for him was correlated with a doubling of President Trump's support among Black male Black Americans.
And he's trying to hide his support in the sense of he came out and said that he wore the Make America Great Again hat, not because it's support for Trump necessarily, but because it's more of a free speech, like, if you can't tell me what to wear, then I can tell me what to wear, you know? Like,
right, yeah.
But it's more of, he's trying to say that he's not supportive of Trump because he knows he's going to get a lot of backlash from that, right? And the more support he can get, then the more power his voice has. So he's using that as like, I don't support Trump necessarily, but I'm still repping the brand. So I'm not saying I support him. But that's like the
yeah. It's also acknowledging him as a human, not some, because it's really easy to make somebody seem like a devil, and definitely there are people on all sides that all do this. But the problem with when you make people seem like the devil is that you take everything off the table and you can't negotiate with him. And the thing about Trump is that, you know, whether you want him impeached or not, and there are certainly a lot of people that do, you know, you can, that could happen, yes, but for the meantime, if you don't want him to destroy the world as you think he will, you should sit down at the table with him and try to negotiate with. And that's the thing that I think Kanye's message has rung true, you know, across the nation, really, with people hearing, is that you can acknowledge the other side without supporting them, without agreeing with them, without, you know, carrying their flag. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested to see how that kind of turns into support for the president and for the party, or at least for the conservative or libertarian movement going forward, and just to notice that you can say what you want.
Right.
Yeah.
It's super cool right now to see that, yeah, there is a lot of internal political conflict because there are so many different things going on. Mm-hmm. But it's also leaking over into the social side. So now there's like this giant social reformation going on that, you know, we can say anything we want, you know, like gay people can get married now. You can like wear whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Like, people are becoming more acceptable of that.
Right, exactly.
Because of this like internal conflict of these year long, like, or a century long old ideals that are like being changed right now. So it's like, even in tech, you know, we have blockchain stuff coming up. It's like this whole industry being flopped over to this new set of ideals. And spiritually, a lot of people are talking about this giant energy shift that just happened, like, at the beginning of the year and, like, in the past few years and months. It's, like, this old ideals of, like, this old spiritual energy is now recreating this new, like, frontier for humanity in general. So it's, like, everything's coming together right now, and it's super cool to see that start in, like, politics and then leak out into social.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that last thing you talked about, the shift in energy, can you elaborate on that? That sounds interesting. Yeah.
So, I don't necessarily like go deep into the whole like horoscopes and like the internal energy of whatever, blah blah blah. But from what I've like studied, at least, is that we have now gone into like a new age. Was it the age of like
Aquarius and Pisces? Like, Pisces was first, and then Aquarius is after, right? Yeah. The water bearer.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we just entered like a new one, and so we actually are, as a society in general, like, shifting consciously. Like, we can't really perceive it. I mean, a lot of people I've talked to have noticed that, like, energy's been different lately, you know, and, like, things that people have been feeling different lately. You can feel it. Like, if you walk around outside, like, it just feels different. And that's just, like, not a natural change that we just see every day. But
I think it's positive and negative, though. People go hard in either direction. Right. I think it's amplifying what people mm-hmm. are already feeling in a lot of ways. And mm-hmm. a lot of these cycles you can trace throughout history. I mean, there are these solar cycles. You have solar minimums. You have mm-hmm. solar flares. In the next 10 years, we've started, I mean, Trump, one great thing he's done is start to strengthen our infrastructure so that if there is a solar flare on the scale of one of the, I think it was the Cassini event or the Carrington event, the Carrington events of the 1860s, where, I mean, these people were talking about something that, you know, in the newspapers, they had solar flare warnings going out, or they were, I guess, explaining what had happened, and you can find some of these headlines. But that was in a time where they had very little technology available to them. And now, if that would happen to us, you know, we're talking about satellites going down. Yeah. We're talking about people, yeah. you know, all of our infrastructure essentially
collapsing. Solar flare in our direction would not be fun. Yeah, no. To say the least. Yeah.
And we're not very equipped for
survival. And not to tangent too far from, like, the Q subject, but, like, all this political stuff that is happening, we are seeing a big change from the old corruption of these different countries and stuff into the new kind of more, like, decentralized, like, people are more sovereign over their own rights and stuff, right? We are seeing this big shift, and
yeah, I think we're seeing a fight between the two. We're seeing a lot of pushback because you really have two ideologies at the end of the day, and really they're two that are one and the same. It's how much should you be free to exercise your own free will and exercise in such a way that's service to self, and how much right. should it be based communally? How much should you give to everyone else? How much should everyone bear the responsibility of being in a society? And these are two ideas which, you know, we talked about East and West having very different opinions on, but that's one of the major differences between Democrats and Republicans. At the end of the day, this is an issue that people have struggled with in different forms and different ways of looking at it, but at the end of the day, it's always the same question that people are asking, and no one's really determined what the balance is, but I think the balance changes with technology, and so the more technology we have, the more we can automate things, the less scarcity there is because there's less labor that's necessary to make a society function, the more a society can operate communally without detracting from their own individual experience and their individual resources that they, you know, need to at least survive on.
That's minimums. What I was getting at. But I was also going to say that Albert Pike once wrote a private letter to, I think it was Mazzini, he basically allotted what he thought, like, the Freemason path to, like, the three world wars were going to be, right? And at the bottom of this, like, this little PDF I found of the subject online, it explained that basically, at the end of, like, World War III or whatever we think it's going to be in this next, if we're not in it now as, like, a psychological war, then whatever is going to happen by the end of, like, these political events that are going on and social changes that are going on, there will need to be people taking back their own sovereignty and their own power. So I think, like, that's, like, the end goal of what Q is trying to do. Q is trying to further the process along with airing out all this, like, bad stuff.
Just airing the dirty laundry.
Right.
exactly.
Yeah, give people a fresh start. I think that's the idea, and that's a theme that's always recurring. He references lots of videos of essentially unshackling people, freeing people. He talked about during his State of the Union, all of the senators that stood and cheered when he mentioned being unshackled, were the senators that he had essentially freed by removing whatever leverage whoever else was operating the system had on them. And if you look at what's happening in the Senate and a lot of government positions, there have been an unprecedented number of resignations. I mean, it's very, very infrequent that a congressman gives up their seat. And we have that in literally dozens of cases. I'm not sure how many are seeking re-election. But if you look at Bannon and the way he talks about his new, I guess, his new mission, he talks about how he can do more good outside the White House for his mission than he can inside the White House. And what he did was go and start finding candidates who are anybody but establishment candidates to run against the establishment on the right. And, you know, that's, I think, just proof that Trump is trying to drain the swamp, and he's trying to out all of the people who have been there and replace them with at least someone who probably isn't as corrupt as the rest. And I don't even blame those people necessarily for what happens, because whenever you're in the midst of some sort of cultural hierarchy where people, you know, there is a culture to where you are, everyone acts a certain way, that's going to rub off on you. There's only so much a person can do to be an individual without adopting some sort of group identity in a lot of ways. And Congress is kind of like a high school. I mean, everyone's got their own offices, and it's all a competition to get the biggest office and the best office, and you think they don't care, but walking around Congress and talking to these people, they care, you know?
It's, if anybody it's in the world cares, it's the,
yeah. You know, and so it's a game, and if once you've been in the game for long enough, you're going to start playing it the way everyone else is. And the way, I guess, to fix the system isn't necessarily to play the game the best, because it seems like all those guys just get caught up in it. It's just to bring a wrecking ball through the game and start over and then reinstitute a new set of ideals at the onset. And I think that's what's being done in a lot of cases.
Exactly. And to tie that back to like the what you're talking about earlier with the split between service to self and service to others, I think that's also finding a vehicle in President Trump's foreign policy too. You know, he's trying to return sovereignty to areas. If you look at the countries that support his repealing of the Iran deal, it's all of Iran's neighbors, and it's like UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Israel. It's all the countries that stand to benefit if Iran were to have scrutinized a nuclear development, or at least the lack thereof. I mean, and all the other regions too, like North Korea is giving them, you know, authority in their own region. I do think that you need to put a limit on that, but the basic message is we're going to let regions handle themselves. We don't need the supranational body of like the UN, where you have the world, the Human Rights Council, yeah, which is basically a rotating board of different countries. You know, I think it's every year, I don't know the exact term, but the countries rotate in and out. So you could have one day the United States, you know, trying to affect something on the board, and the next day you have, you know, Qatar and Yemen, not Yemen, but like Saudi Arabia on the women's rights board. It's just ridiculous. It's a, you know, Trump just, I think, is carrying the message. It might be whispers from Bannon, because I know Bannon's a Leninist as far as institutions go, so he wants to deconstruct all these. But I do think that President Trump is trying to affect the same sort of goal.
Yeah. So I want to touch back on a few more cue points.
Yep.
So there was one instance where he talked about there being a hack on a U.S. submarine on the same day as the summit when he was meeting with Kim Jong-un. And at first it was reported as a Chinese hack, but what Q says is that this was actually a CIA mask hack, a false flag sort of setup trying to lead us into some sort of World War III, or at least send him a message. So there's this constant struggle, he says, between the CIA and his administration. And we know from the Vault 7 leaks that the CIA can mask, you know, essentially mask the traces of who perpetrated an attack. And interestingly, the supposed hacker who ended up extracting all of the information in the Vault 7 leaks from the CIA, they reported that they had caught him and that they also charged him with child pornography possession, which I think is a little bit of a red flag. I mean, if the guy does have child porn, you know,
castrate him.
Yeah, yeah, there's nothing, you can't justify or defend that. But I think that being said, that's exactly how you keep someone quiet if you're framing them for a crime, if you're trying to utterly discredit them. And this is seen time and time again with a lot of the people they end up prosecuting. And it just goes to also show that a lot of times it's easier to entrap someone than to actually catch them in the crime. And a lot of the times when the FBI, and this isn't something, you know, the CIA is doing, but the FBI is essentially running down these crimes, it's a lot easier just to set someone up to fall into one of your legal loophole traps. And that's what happened.
Right. Especially when you're dealing with like organizations. Like if you have people that are pawns in an organization, you can try to, you know, bring them up on weird charges or really minute charges and then say, if you don't take a plea deal, if you don't give us information, we're going to give you a 10-year sentence. And you might win that case. It's chances are you probably could, but I mean, why would you want to take that chance, right? When you just talk to us. And so that's what they did with like Flynn, for example, and then the charges you're talking about. I mean, of course, it'd be like a silly to say that, oh, you know, they brought up, you know, child pornography charges. That must be false. But if you look at Julian Assange, who was one of the most major, I guess, pieces to be felled by the United States government, at least the pursuit of leakers. And they brought him up on charges of rape and sexual assault.
Yeah.
And so, and none of it's been proven. It's been standing for a long time. Was it Swedish trial? I believe Sweden brought the charges.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it might be possible, so we need to caution against it. But we also, that's also the problem with these leaks that come with the FBI and these reports, is that we don't have the faith in institutions anymore to know that when they bring up charges, that they're actual real charges. And that's the long-standing, the really long-lasting harm that this kind of political activity is doing to our institutions like the FBI, CIA, NSA, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think that's just a really scary part of our legal process generally, is the fact that a lot of times we don't get to hear from the perpetrators themselves, especially when it's a crime that affects a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of these school shootings, you know, we haven't heard a word from any of the shooters who actually survived for the first time in history. So we've been wanting for years to ask these kids, why did you do it? You know, everyone wants to know that question. That's the million-dollar question, and they've essentially jump to the conclusion that guns are the problem, and they don't even want to ask or these Vegas. Kids. You know, yeah.
Or Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Was it the United States' worst massacre in history? And yeah. We still haven't heard from... Well,
yeah. He killed himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he killed himself. But we don't have the motive. A lot of the evidence that's slowly trickling out really doesn't support the official story. And and there's no one going, you know, circling back to this stuff.
Yeah.
And somehow all the first-hand witnesses are just disappearing. So it's like... No one's really coming out about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm generally pretty skeptical about conspiracies involving shootings, but this one is like, okay, that's weird. You know, there's just a lot of things. Just the fact that the Saudi Arabia crown prince...
I don't consider that conspiracy anymore. That's like...
Yeah.
It's just like...
It's not, yeah, it's just like, it's a question mark, and it needs to be answered, I think. I think that's the duty of law enforcement, is that when, especially when they have this, they're beclouded by this, like, this giant, you know, muddled pile of just a... I don't know. I don't even know what analogy I was going to use. That's probably a key that I shouldn't. But basically, the fact that they can't have civilians trust in their authority to affect justice and bring people to justice is the issue that we're dealing with. And so the fact that there is a question mark about Vegas, it's not that we're just looking for a reason not to be guns. It's the fact that our institutions don't have the faith they used to have.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this, again, ties back to what the overarching conspiracy is of the whole Q phenomenon, is that essentially Hillary was the last step in this, I guess, sort of journey to tyranny in our country. So, you know, Obama had really set her up to go wild in a lot of ways. And what they talk about is, you know, a fewfold, I guess.
Like with how Hillary Clinton would institute policies to continue that path towards a more authoritarian.
So and you see this with what's happening now. So like essentially what the Democrats have pivoted to is take away the First Amendment, take away the Second Amendment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you have to think what would have happened if Trump had never been around at all. They could have very easily moved into both of those two platform points. Without, I think, a lot of pushback. I mean, obviously, there would be pushback, but I think they could have done it much more cleanly without a guy like Trump, who they really hadn't anticipated. So, you know, they had started by censoring a lot of free speech. I think Hillary probably would have gone the direction of countries like Britain, like the UK. And after that, you know, you go for the Second Amendment, and, you know, a lot of these school shootings are the perfect justification for that. I mean, I don't know what's actually going on. Q has insinuated that these people are essentially being mind controlled. I don't know about that, but you know, a lot of these kids are on psychotropic meds. I've been put on them before. They make you absolutely insane. Your thoughts aren't your own anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think if Hillary would have won, there also would be more voter fraud to come in the future. I know, see, I think it was Tim Draper, the billionaire, wants to split California up into three different states, right? I was looking more into that, and it didn't make sense. But then when I found out that, I think it was like Los Angeles County and a bunch of other different things, they all just got approved for like a grant or something that took like all their voting machines and just gave all the rights to Soros, like basically like that company. So like Soros has a company that makes those machines, right?
Right.
And so
yeah, it's like
they just provide that for all the counties now. So that's, I think, why Draper wanted to split up California in three things, is to at least like limit the power that that would have had in the future elections.
And to the people who say they aren't Soros's machines, I think we went into this on a previous podcast, but he set up this complex company structure where he is not technically the owner. It's set up in Venezuela, I think. And they sell to multiple countries, and all of these countries are the types you would expect to be experiencing voter fraud. So, you know, I certainly can believe that.
Yeah, it's not like it doesn't even matter if there's no proof of that. It goes back to the appearance of bias too. It's like that's just something that when we have people interfering in our political systems, we don't want the appearance that there's something that's going wrong there, because that discredits the entire system. And so having George Soros, who is an active political operative who donates, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to his causes, having him even tangentially related to voting machine, you know, rollouts is very suspect at the very least. Yeah. I mean, I do believe there's something else there too.
Even rather than putting that money into, say, like a decentralized blockchain developed for voting.
Yeah.
I mean, that would keep track of everything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's, Will and I were talking about the other day. We were talking about, I guess we flesh it out a little bit, the idea that you could take a consensus. One. You could take, what we were talking about is building a consensus building, so it's a consensus building platform where you have people who have, say, a general question like, what do you think about abortion, yes or no? And then you create these trees where it's like, yes, okay. Do you think abortion should be at 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? Okay. And so you bring people through these complex trees where you can really figure out where exactly everyone stands on a particular issue. And not only that, you can get to a point where, you know, one of, I think, the biggest, I guess, choke points in our government and our governance is that the president is one person. He has 24 hours in a day. He maybe has 5 hours to sleep. So you're talking about 19 hours in a day to do everything that you would want to do to fix a country, right? There's not enough time in the day, and there's not enough decision-making capacity in a person to do that. But if you have that crowdsourced and you have a lot of people coming up with a lot of solutions to a lot of problems, and you give people the opportunity to, you know, submit their own recommendations, get other people fleshing it out for you. I mean, you want to crowdfund intelligence in a lot of ways, a crowdsource intelligence. And we have a lot of smart people in this country who have a lot of free time to go on Twitter and whine about politics that they might actually spend trying to improve politics, or at least wouldn't have an excuse to go bitch about it in the interim.
Or the transparency of the politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like a big part of it too, is that we can have like this consensus of like what people think, but I think the big key of that is the transparency. So it's like most of the people did actually choose what they wanted, rather than, you know, like the president or whoever picking something that nobody wanted. Now, there's transparency in what people actually voted for. There's transparency in what was actually enacted. So. Yeah,
exactly. And people say like, I don't want the country making decisions for me. The country is just full of stupid voters. But the reality is like not many people vote in this country. Mm-hmm. And the people that do vote are politically knowledgeable. People who vote in primaries are usually wealthy and well-educated. So this is the group that is actually making the decisions regardless. They're just making it a binary decision at the root level. So I do think that if we had more like popular referenda on the state level, where the states get to decide their own policies, and those federal government policies that affect all the states combined get to, you know, take place, maybe you have like a decentralized legislature where people don't accrue in Washington and start buying second homes there and then only traveling back to their states because they have to live there because of the Constitution. You know, it'd be great if we could just have representation kind of devolve onto the states and not just centralize into one area. And I think that's what you're getting at with the decentralization on voting on a blockchain.
And it won't be perfect. I mean, there's still people in it. Like, so if a person is going to still vote on this perfect system, you're still going to have people talking to people and making partnerships and deals under the table about different collusion-based things.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is really, at this point, the misrepresentation by the parties of what the platform is and why it is that way. So they've really failed to articulate why people feel a certain way about things. And that was one thing Trump was really good at. He didn't need a lot of flowery language, but he was really good at articulating emotion and responding with the kind of action that those people wanted as a result of expressing those ideas and those thoughts. So he was an empath in that sense, and I think that's more of what we need, is parties who can articulate what the problem actually is. And that's the thing. Every time they try and tackle a solution, they only tackle solutions when they become a problem. So you don't have them looking ahead and worrying about quantum computing or solar flares, you know, most of the time, because it's not a politically important thing at that very time. But you want them, when they do have to actually approach these problems, to come up with a solution that's, for one thing, they can't come up with an ideal solution because it's already too late. But secondly, you want the solution to actually fix the problem and actually address the solutions that people care about. And right now they figure that out with various polling methods. But as we've seen with their polling, it's not very great. And they can also falsify what the actual political reality is. And so if you look at how much emphasis media outlets put on Twitter, just because all of these reporters love Twitter and they love the dopamine kick that they get when they post something witty. But Twitter is not representative of the country. Most Americans are not on Twitter, especially the rational ones.
It's the emotional bullhorn of the state.
Yeah. But you can have a very outsized influence politically on Twitter because you know, with 10,000 retweets, all of a sudden you're the authority on what the people think, and that's so ridiculous when you think about it.
Oh yeah, it's completely, like, you remember that prom dress thing where that guy's like, my culture's not your prom dress, right? That got 100,000 likes, and people see that and think, oh my gosh, like, that's such a bad thing, I better like this, because this is the group, the majority opinion. But 100,000 people, we have 300 million people in the country, like, 100,000 people is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
But now people can't understand, I mean, I personally can't understand really numbers above, like, 10,000, right? You know, not understand, I mean, just, like, think of the actual amount that means, right? And so once you get to that many people, it's like, oh, that's a huge group, and so I better, you know, conform my opinion to the majority there. But in reality, it's a very minute minority.
Yeah, and that's a very smart way to operate, though, if you're trying to influence public opinion. And I think a lot of people have figured this out, and a lot of people are trying to manipulate it, and that's something Q has mentioned when he talks about consensus cracking, and he talks about these sort of partnerships between Google and Twitter where they negotiate to, you know, take down certain accounts. A lot of the people who post about QAnon, they're told they're Russian bots, they're thrown off the platform. And a lot of the accounts on Twitter are bots, and it's not hard to make a Twitter account and then put in a piece of software that just runs a code that tells you to like and retweet everything with a hashtag. And you see all these people who have 150,000 following and 150,000 followers because they pushed a button and let it run for 2 years. But that's not necessarily indicative of someone who actually has a popular opinion or knows what they're talking about, even though, you know, it probably tricks their algorithms in a lot of cases. And their entire checkmark system is sort of garbage, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, it's completely ridiculous. I think the checkmark system should aim to just verify identity. It shouldn't be verifying celebrity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and
ironically, now they've switched it so that it is just verifying celebrity to a certain number of in the case of a certain number of followers. Because I've had so many clear scammers who these guys have a million following and a million followers with a check mark.
Yeah. I mean,
and
it's you would know about this.
Yeah, that happens all the time, and those people just follow to get the following, and then they can just say they have a big following. It's a marketing thing, right? Yeah. It's like buying your own award.
Ironically, all the people following them are also bots, though. The people following each other are
it's a marketing piece that I have a million followers on Twitter, blah, blah, blah. But I think the big problem, like you're saying, it would be better if it was for identity rather than just a profile, because a lot of people, especially in the crypto space, which is Crypto Economy Podcast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
especially in the crypto space, a lot of the people that are influencers in it are having their accounts, like, essentially taken over, in the sense of a person can hack a verified account, any verified account, and then change the picture and the profile description of all that of another influencer, and then they can start copying their tweets. So it looks like it's that exact influencer because it's the name, the bio, all their tweets sound like them, and they have that blue check mark, so they're verified.
Right.
And so then they're starting to ask for people, like, for money and stuff.
That's a good point. Yeah, because, I mean, I think the problem, too, is that once you even imply that you're going to judge somebody's celebrity and say, like, hey, this, you're going to have two people, and one person is going to be famous according to your definition, and one person's not, that is a completely subjective decision, right? Identity is objective. I mean, it says one of the most objective things you can do is, like, you are who you claim you are. You are... you match the person in the government database, right? But with celebrity, it's like that implies an endorsement almost. And that's the problem with Jack Dorsey, the guy who apologized for eating Chick-fil-A this month or last month. That's why
coming out, at least Steam 2.0 on EOS, Dan's going to eventually create it, is so he says. That's going to be, I think, the biggest turning point for blockchain. Like, other than, like, money being on blockchain, which is huge, but that you can actually, like, digitally sign that it is, yes, me that posted this, that's going to be huge.
Yep. Validity, verification, I agree. Yeah, we're waiting for the blockchain kind of
phenomenon. There's already Twitter on EOS, but...
Oh, there is? Oh,
yeah, wow. Someone made it.
Well, if you want to buy crypto the same way you tweet, you know, there's Cash App and Square. So if you really trust the way that Twitter is run, I would highly suggest Square and Cash App for all your crypto.
And I'm sure y'all saw that tweet that Jack Dorsey tweeted out with a picture of the license plate, and it said it was a bit license or something like that. But so this is an interesting kind of phenomenon that happened with him, is that the fact that he tweeted that out, it meant that, was it Ethereum rose, I think, 5%, 3%, something like that. And it was a crazy jump, but that indicates that the whole centralization thing is, it's like falling into the way of the stock market, right?
Yeah.
Like the fact that he announced news and that created an influx in the price, that to me is something that's like, I don't like that at all. That's complete. I mean, I know that's a market force. I understand that, but it's like, I just, as somebody who doesn't study economics, I don't like it. Exactly.
Well, so, I mean, here's the problem. So the problem really is, the reason the price jumped is because the government has put up these high barriers to entry to exchanges to get licenses in places like, especially New York. So they just got the license in New York, but New York is the hardest state to get the license in, which means they pretty much have a clear path to the rest of the states. But what the problem you have really is that these people have become the gatekeepers to the currency, because there aren't better alternatives for people to buy it elsewhere, which is why when Coinbase lists a coin, it jumps 25%, just because all of a sudden people who never had access now have access using the means that they have for other things. So you're opening up a consumer base who really hasn't had access to Ethereum with the same, you know, Venmo-like app that they use anyway, and all of a sudden they can just store their money in crypto instead. And that's going to naturally cause a lot more buy orders, and the buy orders are going to drive the price up because just more people are buying it. Yeah, it's like, a natural.
And what happens from that too is that there's an even bigger jump because a lot of people are either shorting or longing on margin. So then when you have like a 10x short, and then that happens, and there's like a small jump from like Jack tweeting, like say there's a 2% jump, and then it short like liquidates everybody, and it's going to jump up even more, and then it's going to have its own.
And you have that to an even greater extent with futures markets. So the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME, I think just announced that they're adding Ethereum as well as Bitcoin. Well, if you remember when Bitcoin had its sort of meteoric rise in December, that was largely in response to the CME listing it, but that's twofold. So on one hand, you give people the option to buy large quantities at a relatively low price, but you allow them to execute at different price levels. So every time Bitcoin hit a new high, say it hit, you know, 8,500, all of a sudden all these people, you know, 100 orders will execute because that would be the call price of whatever they're exercising. And then you have it shoot up, you know, another 100 shares worth of buying, and that hits the next guy's buy signal or buy, whatever it is, option call trigger. That's not the word I'm trying to think of, but whatever. But at the same time, it opens it up to downward pressure for the first time really ever. So people can short, and they can short massively more of a quantity than they would previously have had the capital to do previously. So just like you can have sell or buy orders that shoot it up, you know, 200-300%, you can have it the same way in the downward direction. So that we could see something similar, I think, happen with Ether once that opens up.
Yeah, and I just want to make a quick note that when the futures were announced for CME in November of 2017, you know, I was kind of looking at it like, this is going to be interesting, right? They launched and they officially started trading in December. I think it was December 17th, right at the peak of like 20,000. And their current like contract like set ends June 29th, right at the bottom. So, I mean, there can't be a coincidence, right? I mean,
always pay attention to when those contracts expire.
And these represents like the CME you're talking about. That's a government, not a government, it's a government regulated institution, right? So that's a single institution.
It's more legitimate.
And they're making market movements, and their movements are causing retaliatory movements in the price. And so like, how can that ever be decentralized if single institutions can do that?
Right. You so have that's why I'm saying as many institutions as possible open it up.
Right.
To people.
Yeah. So I'm just saying it's like we're still there. I feel like the point where the currency aspect can be decentralized is still far away. Like we are nowhere near that, in my opinion. But like that's why I'm excited to see, like you're talking about with EOS, like the blockchain model move into something else to work and adapt to something that doesn't have to be financial.
Yeah, yeah. Just the decentralization in as many, and we've been working on the miners as well. Yeah. So hopefully we can decentralize mining, which I think is a big problem right now, and open it up to more people, give them access to a lot of coins.
Decentralization in general is going to be really tough. And that's like the problem that humanity is going to have to solve. Like, we haven't had decentralization for thousands of years. So we're trying to solve that right now in a matter of like 10 years since Bitcoin's been out.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think as long as a person is going to be in the process at all of the back end of development, of mining, decentralization is just a philosophy. I mean, it's something we're all shooting for, but
it's an aim.
Unless it's like out of the human hands, I don't know if it's possible.
I think technology allows it to become more and more possible because information, the amount of time it takes for information to travel keeps getting shorter and shorter, and the more that is, the more you can decentralize everything, and also the more you can automate the processes that might need to be centralized. And that's exactly what crypto is in both respects. And so you're giving people the ability to I guess, you know, whether it's voting, you know, the whole reason Rome had a republic was because everyone can't show up at the same day and talk about everything. But now on Twitter, we have public conversations every day about any range of topics. And so you can have the input of an entire society. And whether that's efficient or not, I'm not sure, but it's not very efficient right now. So I can't imagine it would be that much less efficient. And I think it's always going to be scary to move from something that's centralized and can be controlled to something that's decentralized, where there's more likelihood of volatility in all respects, but it's better for everyone involved. And you know, I'm hoping that company structures start to decentralize in a lot of ways. Another thing we were talking about is using a similar model for voting, but within a company structure, so that shareholders have more of an opportunity to influence company direction and make major decisions, instead of just, you know, once every 4 months, you can have shareholders talking about this stuff on a daily basis and interacting with the company and helping the CEO, you know, make more decisions than he can make on his own. And I think the more you do that, the more you're going to give the people who are involved in organizations ownership in their outcomes, and you're going to give them the ability to harness whatever, I guess, creative ideas and whatever intelligence they have to get themselves embedded in whatever social or economic function that they are a part of.
Right, yeah, we want a way for the people that are the activists, the people that want to affect change in the system, the people that actually care, including the actual representatives, right? I mean, it's unfair to say that all the representatives don't care, right? I mean, I can't possibly evaluate that. But I think it'd be cool to have a way where we can have people that do want effect change, have a way where they can do so with also retaining the gridlock that we have now. Because I do think that gridlock is very important. Like, gridlock is built into our system for a reason, and it's the reason that we're, like, the last essentially free country in the world. Like, not free in terms of positive rights where you have free healthcare, but free in terms of, like, immunities from the government encroachment.
Yeah.
And so the reason that we have that, I think, is because we don't have, you know, Congress that's passing laws every second of the day that's saying, hey, we're going to fix this. But, like, the problem is that, I mean, that's a problem with centralization as well. So if you decentralize it and make it more efficient as far as the process for voting and the process for getting input, I like the idea of that, as long as there's some sort of structural limitation on how many laws can be passed and the sessions that they have, so it's not just an emotional body that's, you know, always just passing laws.
Oh, yeah, of course. But that would be an interesting case study, too. See how a society adapts with minute-by-minute changes,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
That would be interesting as well.
I just don't want Twitter to vote on hate speech laws.
And yeah. But at the same time, if you break it down to a state level and do it as an experiment there, then you can do it in a controlled environment where you can always move away. And that's really how the foundation of America was supposed to be, is that every state really had autonomy, the federal government wasn't overreaching, and that everyone could always vote with their feet if they didn't like what was happening where they're living. And 50 options is a lot of variables. But unfortunately, most states, the laws are pretty much the same. Just, you know, there are a few differences as far as, you know, how badly they'll prosecute you for certain crimes and what the relative weight they place on different offenses is. But for the most part, the same things are illegal everywhere.
Right. The difference is in the execution and the administration. In the culture, those differ wildly. And so I do, like, back on what you're saying about the states and the voting thing, like, the really cool part about American history is that all the suffrage movements that happened, including, like, the the Black American Suffrage Movement and the Female American Suffrage Movement in the early 20th century, those start at the state level. Those started because certain states had grassroots movements, and they marched in the national legislature. They voted for bills saying, okay, it's time for women to be able to vote in the state of Wyoming or in the state of, you know, Nebraska. And so those that started like a domino effect, and that's how we got it on a federal level. It didn't start with national protests, you know, trying to march on Washington and getting them to pass bills. I mean, that doesn't happen until you get the states to do it too, because the federal government is nothing without the states. So if we had the states implement some sort of more efficient voting system that took into account the democratic aspect a lot more, I think that it could create a sort of domino effect on the whole government.
Yeah, and if you think about what protests do to political discourse now, all they do is articulate a very vague message as to what they want policy mm-hmm. priorities to be, but almost nothing about what the policy itself should be. And so they give their congressmen free rein on how to address the situation, which is the opposite of what you want to be doing. You want to be as much involved in the actual execution of what you want as the direction that you want things going in. You know, when a lot of these people march, there are so many protests that mean pretty much nothing. They're so vague, you know. There's so many names for them, you know, like
March for Life.
Yeah, J20 or whatever else.
I haven't even been here that long, and I've seen a few of them. I think it's exactly what you're saying, but I think it's also just like this emotional release for all these people that feel like they're getting the short end of the stick,
mm-hmm.
and that
mm-hmm.
they can do something about it by marching, but they don't really have an effect.
Yeah.
If anything, the march is like a release for them almost.
Right.
It is a release, but it's not a productive release. And that's what I think the problem is exactly. All these people are getting so worked up about something that is important, which is exciting, but you should give them an outlet so that they can actually affect change in a way that is going to keep them from, you know, week one to week two going out and marching the next week. You know, like there's like only, you want to actually fix the problem at some point.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic too. Like they think the main obstacle for them is like the Republican side and the opposition, but their biggest obstacle is that sense of satisfaction they get when they go on a protest. Cause they're like, I did something. Yeah. I go home and, okay, the policy is the same text as it was yesterday, and it has been for 500 years. So what did you do besides make yourself feel better?
Yeah.
You know, it was a release.
And I mean, a lot of them are shutting down highways, and my aunt's an ER doctor, and she was talking about the fact that there were ambulances stuck on the highway with people dying in them because these people were whining about something in the middle of a freeway.
Yeah,
happened, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's like, be smart at least about the way you're doing these things as to not negatively affect all the poor people around you. But with that being said, I don't know if you guys have any.
Yeah, I think we've been hitting a lot at 49 a month. I think we should give some more details about the stuff we've been doing here because we're about to go into more into a larger mechanical mode with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to, so give us an overview of the 49er mile. What have we done?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been prototyping for a while. We've got two of them set up right now, so we're figuring out how we can network Antminers in with the main base unit, so that way if, say, you want to focus on one coin, we can easily ship you something out that you can just plug in your garage. We want to make sure that you can do so without having to keep the Antminers necessarily in your home, because those things are loud as hell. But the base 49er miners that we've built have been pretty quiet, really efficient. We've been testing them with VR, with the Oculus, mm-hmm. With games. We've been playing some Fortnite. Will's trying to figure out how to develop sort of a custom Windows OS package to put on top so we can prepackage a bunch of interesting apps that we've developed and things like Oculus, but also other crypto apps.
Right.
We're looking into doing like a developer version for people who are trying to test a lot of the crypto and blockchain products that they're creating. We're hoping we can get the miners to a point with some partnerships where your miner can order you, you know, food from Uber Eats or weed from a dispensary, or whatever else, and it can just sit there and use your earnings to pay for things that you're using anyway or subscriptions to certain things online. So we're starting to automate that. We've got it all hooked up with the phone app so you can control fan speeds. All the compartments are motorized so it opens to cool the unit. Been playing around with all the LED settings, thinking about putting some little screens in there so that you can keep an eye on what's happening. We're trying to figure out, we're going to have two models likely at the beginning, a more base model with probably just one GPU and a bigger model with, you know, four or five. We're trying to figure
out. Up to 19, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, we have slots for 19 at this point.
Exactly.
so, you know, it's. Yeah, but we're trying to figure out a way to keep the price as low as we can, but still give people enough value so that, you know, they can really see how it works as an investment.
Yep.
And that's, you know, a fine line to draw, and we're trying to give you guys as much value as we can while still figuring out how we can make enough money just to keep making them.
And right. We want the image of 2050 to be what? A quantum computer running AI mining in the background plugged into a solar panel.
Yeah.
That would be the best. That's the goal of humanity right now, I think. Benevolent
for.
AI, of course. Yeah. So Elon Musk, if you're listening, don't come after me. I'm not developing it to come after you and Grimes. So.
Yeah.
I'll just concentrate on your fires at Tesla, bro. Okay.
So we're just trying to turn that into really the hardware facing brand of our company. And we've been playing around with cold wallets and a bunch of exciting accessories. So this thing can be pretty much whatever you want it to be. And we're just trying to figure out exactly how to articulate that. We've had a couple people put in pre-orders and we really appreciate that. We're going to make sure we get those things to you. If we end up changing the price, you know, we'll end up still
refunding.
We'll send you one anyway. The prices are close enough now that, you know, I can lose $250 or whatever. But we're still trying to nail down exactly how much we can sell these things for when we take into account labor and shipping, which is about $200 because these things are built super solid. But the cool thing about that is it's also one of the most kick-ass cold wallets you can have. And, you know, no one's running off with that thing because it's, you know, 40, 50 pounds and solid metal.
Exactly.
So we're trying to make it really the centerpiece of crypto for your home.
Jared, before we go, book recommendation for the audience.
Oh.
Yeah, just top of your
head. Any book?
Any book, yeah. What do you want somebody to read that's listening?
Rulers of Evil. You're going to find it on Amazon, but it's out of print, so it's going to be $600. So I recommend going to Google, finding the PDF. It's called Rulers of Evil by Tupper, like Saucy or something like that.
Okay. And if you do want to follow the law, buy a miner, and then you can mine $600.
Yeah.
Order and print.
We'll put up some pictures on Twitter, some previews. We're trying to get a better video made. That way we can show you guys a little bit of what we've been up to. And I know we haven't been doing as many podcasts. We've been busy with hardware, with stuff all over the place. But we're finally getting that all sorted. And I know a few people have talked about trying to subscribe on other platforms. I think some people think this is just on Anchor, but we're literally everywhere. iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. We're on
all the podcast one.
Crypto Economy Podcast. So do, you know, if you can subscribe on all the platforms that you have, that helps us a lot.
And we're thinking about going the route of YouTube and SoundCloud, but we don't want to do anything needlessly. So if people are listening on SoundCloud, YouTube who want to, and you do want to do that, then just shoot us a message and we'll put those up there too.
Yeah.
But as far as that goes, I think that wraps it up. Good Q episode.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being here, Jared.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks you guys for listening through this whole thing. And we're going to be back with more. We'll let you know when we have our next guest scheduled. Should be soon.
Yep. Awesome.
Where
all right.
One goes, we all go.
Great finishing
we'll
words.
We'll let that comment stand. Yeah.
This election will decide whether we are ruled by a corrupt political class. You're seeing what's happening. Everybody's watching. Or whether we are ruled by the people. We're going to be ruled by the people, folks. Tomorrow's going to be a very historic day. I really believe that. I think it's going to show. I think it's going to be a Brexit plus, plus, plus. Does that make sense? Plus, plus, plus.